furthermore told the Negroes they were as good as the whites in every way, and soon white and Negro marriages would be permitted. Soon the estates of their former owners would be divided, and every Negro would be given 40 acres and a mule for his own. They kept the Negro stirred up with tales of cruelty perpetrated by the whites, and in a section long famed for the affectionate relations between slaves and slave owners, hate and suspicion began to grow. The Bureau was backed up by the soldiers, and the military had issued many and conflicting orders governing the conduct of the conquered. It was easy to get arrested, even for snubbing the officials of the Bureau. Military orders had been promulgated concerning the schools, sanitation, the kind of buttons one wore on one's suit, the sale of commodities, and nearly everything else. Wilkerson and Hilton had the power to interfere in any trade Scarlet might make, and to fix their own prices on anything she sold or swapped. Fortunately, Scarlet had come into contact with the two men very little, for Will had persuaded her to let him handle the trading while she managed the plantation. In his mild-tempered way, Will had straightened out several difficulties of this kind and said nothing to her about them. Will could get along with carpetbaggers and Yankees if he had to. But now, a problem had arisen which was too big for him to handle. The extra tax assessment and the danger of losing Terra were matters Scarlet had to know about. And right away, she looked at him with flashing eyes. "Oh, damn, the Yankees!" she cried. "Isn't it enough that they've licked us and beggared us without turning loose scoundrels on us?" The war was over. Peace had been declared. But the Yankees could still rob her. They could still starve her. They could still drive her from her house. And fool that she was, she had thought through weary months that if she could just hold on until spring, everything would be all right. This crushing news brought by Will, coming on top of a year of back-breaking work and hope deferred, was the last straw. "Oh, Will, I thought our troubles were all over when the war ended." "No." Will raised his lantern-jawed, country-looking face and gave her a long, steady look. "Our troubles are just getting started."
"How much extra taxes do they want us to pay?"
$300. She was struck dumb for a moment. $300? It might just as well be $3 million.
"Why," she floundered, why, then we've got to raise 300 somehow."
"Yes'm. And a rainbow and a moon or two."
"Oh, but Will, they couldn't sell out Terra. Why?"
His mild, pale eyes showed more hate and bitterness than she thought possible.
"Oh, couldn't they?
Well, they could and they will, and they'll lack doing it. Miss Scarlet, the country's gone plumb to hell, if you'll pardon me. Those carpet baggers and scallywags can vote, and most of us Democrats can't. Can't no Democrat in this state vote if he was on the tax books for more than $2,000.65. That lets out folks like your pa and Mr. Tarleton and the MacRae's and the Fontaine boys. Can't nobody vote who was a colonel and over in the war. And Miss Scarlet, I bet this state's got more colonels than any state in the Confederacy. And can't nobody vote who held office under the Confederate government, and that lets out everybody from the notaries to the judges. And the woods are full of folks like that. The fact is, the way the Yankees have framed up that amnesty oath, can't nobody who was somebody before the war vote at all. Not the smart folks, nor the quality folks, nor the rich folks." "I could vote if I took the damned oath. I didn't have any money in 65, and I certainly weren't a colonel, nor nothing remarkable.
But I ain't going to take the oath. Not by a dinged sight. If the Yankees had acted right, I'd have taken the oath of allegiance, but I ain't now. I can be restored to the Union, but I can't be reconstructed into it. I ain't going to take the oath even if I don't never vote again. But scum like that Hilton fella, he can vote. And scoundrels like Jonas Wilkerson. And poor whites like the Slatterys and no-counts like the McIntoshes, they can vote. And they're running things now. And if they want to come down on you for extra taxes a dozen times, they can do it. Just like a nigger can kill a white man and not get hung. He paused, embarrassed. And the memory of what had happened to a lone white woman on an isolated farm near Lovejoy was in both their minds. Those niggers can do anything against us, and the Freedmen's Bureau and the soldiers will back them up with guns. And we can't vote or do nothing about it. Vote, she cried. Vote? What on earth has voting got to do with all this, Will? It's taxes we're talking about. Well, everybody knows what a good plantation terra is. We could mortgage it for enough to pay the taxes if we had to. Miss Scarlet. You ain't any fool, but sometimes you talk like one. Who's got any money to lend you on this property? Who except the carpetbaggers who are trying to take Tara away from you? Why, everybody's got land. Everybody's land poor. You can't give away land. I've got those diamond earbobs I got off that Yankee. We could sell them. Miss Scarlet, who round here has got money for earbobs? Folks ain't got money to buy side meat, let alone gigaws. If you've got $10 in gold, I'll take oath that's more than most folks have got. They were silent again, and Scarlet felt as if she were butting her head against a stone wall. There had been so many stone walls to butt against this last year. What are we going to do, Miss Scarlet? I don't know, she said dully, and felt that she didn't care. This was one stone wall too many, and she suddenly felt so tired that her bones ached. Why should she work and struggle and wear herself out? At the end of every struggle, it seemed that defeat was waiting to mock her. I don't know, she said. But don't let Paul know. It might worry him. I won't. Have you told anyone? No, I came right to you. Yes, she thought. Everyone always came right to her with bad news. And she was tired of it. Where's Mr. Wilkes? Perhaps he'll have some suggestion. Will turned his mild gaze on her, and she felt, as from the first day when Ashley came home, that he knew everything. He's down in the orchard splitting rails. I heard his axe when I was putting up the horse. But he ain't got any money any more than we have. If I want to talk to him about it, I can't I? She snapped, rising to her feet and kicking the fragment of quilting from her ankles. Will didn't take offense, but continued rubbing his hands before the flame. Better get your shawl, Miss Scarlet. It's raw outside. But she went without the shawl, for it was upstairs, and her need to see Ashley and lay her troubles before him was too urgent to wait. How lucky for her if she could find him alone. Never once since his return had she had a private word with him. Always the family clustered about him. Always Melanie was by his side, touching his sleeve now and again, to reassure herself he was really there. The sight of that happy, possessive gesture had aroused in Scarlet all the jealous animosity which had slumbered during the months when she had thought Ashley probably dead. Now she was determined to see him alone. This time, no one was going to prevent her from talking with him alone.
She went through the orchard under the bare boughs, and the damp weeds beneath them wet her feet. She could hear the sound of the axe ringing as Ashley split into rails the logs hauled from the swamp. Replacing the fences the Yankees had so blithely burned was a long, hard task. Everything was a long, hard task, she thought wearily, as she was tired of it, tired and mad and sick of it all. If only Ashley were her husband instead of Melanie's, how sweet it would be to go to him and lay her head upon his shoulder and cry, and shove her burdens onto him, to work out as best he might. She rounded a thicket of pomegranate trees, which were shaking bare limbs in the cold wind, and saw him leaning on his axe, wiping his forehead with the back of his hand. He was wearing the remains of his butternut trousers, and one of Gerald's shirts, a shirt which in better times went only to court days and barbecues, a ruffled shirt, which was far too short for its present owner. He had hung his coat on a tree limb, for the work was hot, and he stood resting as she came up to him. At the sight of Ashley in rags, with an axe in his hand, her heart went out in a surge of love and of fury at fate. She couldn't bear to see him in tatters working, her debonair, immaculate Ashley. His hands were not made for work, or his body for anything but broadcloth and fine linen. God intended him to sit in a great house, talking with pleasant people, playing the piano and writing things which sounded beautiful and made no sense whatsoever. She could endure the sight of her own child in aprons made of sacking, and the girls in dingy old gingham, could bear it that Will worked harder than any field hand, but not Ashley. He was too fine for all this, too infinitely dear to her. She would rather split logs herself than suffer while he did it. "They say Abe Lincoln got his start splitting rails," he said as she came up to him. "Just think to what heights I may climb." She frowned. He was always saying light things like this about their hardships. They were deadly serious matters to her, and sometimes she was almost irritated at his remarks. Abruptly she told him Will's news, tersely and in short words, feeling a sense of relief as she spoke. Surely he'd have something helpful to offer. He said nothing, but, seeing her shiver, he took his coat and placed it about her shoulders. "Well," she said finally, "doesn't it occur to you that we'll have to get the money somewhere?" "Yes," he said, "but where?" "I'm asking you," she replied, annoyed. The sense of relief at unburdening herself had disappeared. Even if he couldn't help, why didn't he say something comforting? Even if it was only, "Oh, I'm so sorry." He smiled. "In all these months since I've been home, I've only heard of one person, Rhett Butler, who actually has money," he said. At Pittypat had written Melanie the week before that Rhett was back in Atlanta, with a carriage and two fine horses and pocketfuls of greenbacks. She had intimated, however, that he didn't come by them honestly. Aunt Pitty had a theory, largely shared by Atlanta, that Rhett had managed to get away with the mythical millions of the Confederate treasury. "Don't let's talk about him," said Scarlett shortly. "He's a skunk if ever there was one. What's to become of us all?" Ashley put down the axe and looked away, and his eyes seemed to be journeying to some far-off country where she could not follow. "I wonder," he said. "I wonder not only what will become of us at Terra, but what will become of everybody in the South." She felt like snapping out abruptly, "To hell with everybody in the South! What about us?" But she remained silent, because the tired feeling was back on her more strongly than ever. Ashley wasn't being any help at all. In the end, what will happen will be what has happened whenever a civilization breaks up. The people who have brains and courage come through, and the ones who haven't are winnowed out. At least, it has been interesting, if not comfortable, to witness a Goethe Dämmerung.
A what?
A dusk of the gods. Unfortunately, we Southerners did think we were gods.
For heaven's sake, Ashley Wilkes, don't stand there and talk nonsense at me when it's us who are going to be winnowed out. Something of her exasperated weariness seemed to penetrate his mind, calling it back from its wanderings. For he raised her hands with tenderness and, turning them palm up, looked at the calluses.
"These are the most beautiful hands I know," he said. And he kissed each palm lightly. "They are beautiful because they are strong, and every callus is a metal scarlet, every blister an award for bravery and unselfishness. They've been roughened for all of us, your father, the girls, Melanie, the baby, the Negroes, and for me. My dear, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, here stands an impractical fool talking tommy rot about dead gods when living people are in danger. Isn't that true?" She nodded, wishing he would keep on holding her hands forever. But he dropped them. "And you came to me hoping I could help you." "Well, I can't." His eyes were bitter as he looked toward the axe and the pile of logs. "My home is gone. And all the money that I so took for granted, I never realized I had it. And I am fitted for nothing in this world, for the world I belonged in has gone. I can't help you, Scarlet, except by learning with as good grace as possible to be a clumsy farmer. And that won't keep Tara for you. Don't you think I realize the bitterness of our situation living here on your charity? Oh, yes, Scarlet, your charity. I can never repay you what you've done for me and for mine out of the kindness of your heart. I realize it more acutely every day. And every day I see more clearly how helpless I am to cope with what has come on us all. Every day my accursed shrinking from realities makes it harder for me to face the new realities. Do you know what I mean?" She nodded. She had no very clear idea what he meant, but she clung breathlessly on his words. This was the first time he had ever spoken to her of the things he was thinking when he seemed so remote from her. It excited her, as if she were on the brink of a discovery. "It's a curse, this not wanting to look on naked realities. Until the war, life was never more real to me than a shadow show on a curtain. And I preferred it so. I do not like the outlines of things to be too sharp. I like them gently blurred, a little hazy." He stopped and smiled faintly, shivering a little as the cold wind went through his thin shirt. "In other words, Scarlet, I'm a coward." His talk of shadow shows and hazy outlines conveyed no meaning to her, but his last words were in a language she could understand. She knew they were untrue. Cowardice was not in him. Every line of his slender body spoke of generations of brave and gallant men, and Scarlet knew his war record by heart. Why, that's not so. Would a coward have climbed on the cannon at Gettysburg and rallied the men? Would the general himself have written Melanie a letter about a coward? And that's not courage, he said tiredly. Fighting is like champagne. It goes to the heads of cowards as quickly as of heroes.
Any fool can be brave on a battlefield when it's be brave or else be killed. I'm talking of something else. And my kind of cowardice is infinitely worse than if I had run the first time I heard a cannon fired.
His words came slowly and with difficulty, as if it hurt to speak them, and he seemed to stand off and look with a sad heart at what he had said. Had any other man spoken so, Scarlet would have dismissed such protestations contemptuously as mock modesty and a bid for praise. But Ashley seemed to mean them, and there was a look in his eyes which eluded her, not fear, not apology, but the bracing to a strain which was inevitable and overwhelming. The wintry wind swept her damp ankles, and she shivered again, but her shiver was less from the wind than from the dread his words evoked in her heart.
"But, Ashley, what are you afraid of?"
"Oh, nameless things. Things which sound very silly when they are put into words. Mostly of having life suddenly become too real, of being brought into too personal contact with some of the simple facts of life. It isn't that I mind splitting logs here in the mud, but I do mind what it stands for. I do mind very much the loss of the beauty of the old life I loved. Scarlet, before the war, life was beautiful. There was a glamour to it, a perfection and a completeness and a symmetry to it, like Grecian art. Maybe it wasn't so to everyone. I know that now. But to me, living at 12 Oaks, there was a real beauty to living. I belonged in that life. I was a part of it. And now it's gone, and I am out of place in this new life. And I'm afraid. Now I know that in the old days it was a shadow show I watched. I avoided everything which was not shadowy, people and situations which were too real, too vital. I resented their intrusion. I tried to avoid you too, Scarlet. You were too full of living and too real, and I was cowardly enough to prefer shadows and dreams.
But, Nellie...
Melanie is the gentlest of dreams, and a part of my dreaming. And if the war had not come, I would have lived out my life happily buried at 12 Oaks, contentedly watching life go by, and never being a part of it. But when the war came, life as it really is thrust itself against me. The first time I went into action, it was at Bull Run, you remember. I saw my boyhood friends blown to bits and heard dying horses scream and learned the sickeningly horrible feeling of seeing men crumple up and spit blood when I shot them. But those weren't the worst things about the war, Scarlet. The worst thing about the war was the people I had to live with. I'd sheltered myself from people all my life. I had carefully selected my few friends. But the war taught me I had created a world of my own with dream people in it. It taught me what people really are. But it didn't teach me how to live with them. And I'm afraid I'll never learn. Now I know that in order to support my wife and child, I will have to make my way among a world of people with whom I have nothing in common. You, Scarlet, are taking life by the horns and twisting it to your will. But where do I fit in the world anymore? I tell you, I'm afraid. While his low, resonant voice went on desolate, with a feeling she could not understand, Scarlet clutched at words here and there, trying to make sense of them. But the words swooped from her hands like wild birds. Something was driving him with a cruel goad, but she did not understand what it was. Scarlet, I don't know just when it was that the bleak realization came over me that my own private shadow show was over. Perhaps in the first 5 minutes at Bull Run when I saw the first man I killed drop to the ground. But I knew it was over, and I could no longer be a spectator. No, I suddenly found myself on the curtain, an actor, posturing and making futile gestures. My little inner world was gone, invaded by people whose thoughts were not my thoughts, whose actions were as alien as a Hottentot's. They'd tramped through my world with slimy feet, and there was no place left where I could take refuge when things became too bad to stand. When I was in prison, I thought, when the war is over, I can go back to the old life and the old dreams, and watch the shadow show again. But, Scarlet, there's no going back. And this which is facing all of us now is worse than war, and worse than prison, and to me, worse than death. So you see, Scarlet, I'm being punished for being afraid. But Ashley, she began, floundering in a quagmire of bewilderment. If you're afraid we'll starve, why... Oh, Ashley will manage somehow. I know we will. For a moment, his eyes came back to her, wide and crystal gray, and there was admiration in them. Then suddenly they were remote again, and she knew with a sinking heart that he had not been thinking about starving. They were always like two people talking to each other in different languages. But she loved him so much that when he withdrew, as he had now done, it was like the warm sun going down and leaving her in chilly twilight dews. She wanted to catch him by the shoulders and hug him to her, make him realize that she was flesh and blood and not something he had read or dreamed. If she could only feel that sense of oneness with him, for which she had yearned since that day so long ago when he had come home from Europe and stood on the steps of Terra and smiled up at her. "Starving's not pleasant," he said. "I know, for I've starved, but I'm not afraid of that. I'm afraid of facing life without the slow beauty of our old world that is gone." Scarlet thought despairingly that Melanie would know what he meant. Melanie and he were always talking such foolishness. Poetry and books and dreams and moon rays and stardust. He was not fearing the things she feared. Not the gnawing of an empty stomach, nor the keenness of the winter wind, nor eviction from Terra. He was shrinking before some fear she had never known and could not imagine. For in God's name, what was there to fear in this wreck of a world but hunger and cold and the loss of home? And she had thought that if she listened closely, she would know the answer to Ashley. "Oh," she said, and the disappointment in her voice was that of a child who opens a beautifully wrapped package to find it empty. At her tone, he smiled ruefully as though apologizing. "Forgive me, Scarlet, for talking so. I can't make you understand because you don't know the meaning of fear. You have the heart of a lion and an utter lack of imagination, and I envy you both of those qualities. You'll never mind facing realities, and you'll never want to escape from them, as I do." Escape? It was as if that were the only understandable word he had spoken. Ashley, like her, was tired of the struggle and he wanted to escape. Her breath came fast. "Oh, Ashley," she cried, "you're wrong. I do want to escape, too. I'm so very tired of it all." His eyebrows went up in disbelief, and she laid a hand, feverish and urgent, on his arm. "Listen to me," she began swiftly, the words tumbling out one over the other.
I'm tired of it all, I tell you. Bone tired. And I'm not going to stand it any longer. I've struggled for food and for money, and I've weeded and hoed and picked cotton, and I've even ploughed until I can't stand it another minute. I tell you, Ashley, the South is dead. It's dead. The Yankees and the free niggers and the carpetbaggers have got it, and there's nothing left for us. Ashley, let's run away.
He peered at her sharply, lowering his head to look into her face, now flaming with color.
Yes, let's run away. Leave them all. I'm tired of working for the folks. Somebody will take care of them. There's always somebody who takes care of people who can't take care of themselves. Oh, Ashley, let's run away, you and I. We could go to Mexico. They want officers in the Mexican army, and we could be so happy there. I'd work for you, Ashley. I'd do anything for you. You know you don't love Melanie.
He started to speak, a stricken look on his face. But she stemmed his words with a torrent of her own.
You told me you loved me better than her that day. Oh, you remember that day? And I know you haven't changed. I can tell you haven't changed. And you've just said she was nothing but a dream. Oh, Ashley, let's go away. I could make you so happy. And anyway, she added venomously, Melanie can't. Dr. Fontaine said she couldn't ever have any more children, and I could give you...
His hands were on her shoulders so tightly that they hurt, and she stopped, breathless. We were to forget that day at 12 Oaks.
Do you think I could ever forget it? Have you forgotten it? Can you honestly say you don't love me?
He drew a deep breath and answered quickly. No, I don't love you.
That's a lie.
Even if it is a lie, said Ashley, and his voice was deadly quiet. It is not something which can be discussed.
You mean, do you think I could go off and leave Melanie and the baby, even if I hated them both? Break Melanie's heart? Leave them both to the charity of friends? Scarlett, are you mad? Isn't there any sense of loyalty in you? You couldn't leave your father and the girls. They're your responsibility, just as Melanie and Beau are mine, and whether you're tired or not, they are here, and you've got to bear them.
I could leave them. I'm sick of them, tired of them.
He leaned toward her, and for a moment, she thought with a catch at her heart that he was going to take her in his arms. But instead, he patted her arm and spoke as one comforting a child. I know you're sick and tired. That's why you're talking this way. You've carried the load of three men. But I'm going to help you. I won't always be so awkward.
There's only one way you can help me, she said dully. And that's to take me away from here and give us a new start somewhere with a chance for happiness. There's nothing to keep us here.
Nothing, he said quietly. Nothing except honor. She looked at him with baffled longing and saw, as if for the first time, how the crescents of his lashes were the thick, rich gold of ripe wheat. How proudly his head sat upon his bared neck, and how the look of race and dignity persisted in his slim, erect body even through its grotesque rags. Her eyes met his, hers naked with pleading, his remote as mountain lakes under gray skies. She saw in them defeat of her wild dream, her mad desires. Heartbreak and weariness sweeping over her, she dropped her head in her hands and cried. He had never seen her cry. He had never thought that women of her strong metal had tears, and a flood of tenderness and remorse swept him. He came to her swiftly and in a moment had her in his arms, cradling her comfortingly, pressing her black head to his heart, whispering, Dear, my brave dear, don't. You mustn't cry. At his touch, He felt her change within his grip, and there was madness and magic in the slim body he held, and a hot, soft glow in the green eyes which looked up at him. Of a sudden, it was no longer bleak winter. For Ashley, spring was back again. That half-forgotten balmy spring of green rustlings and murmurings, a spring of ease and indolence, careless days when the desires of youth were warm in his body. The bitter years since then fell away, and he saw that the lips turned up to his were red and trembling. And he kissed her. There was a curious low roaring sound in her ears, as of seashells held against them, and through the sound she dimly heard the swift thudding of her heart. Her body seemed to melt into his, and for a timeless time they stood fused together as his lips took hers hungrily, as if he could never have enough. When he suddenly released her, she felt that she could not stand alone and gripped the fence for support. She raised eyes blazing with love and triumph to him. "You do love me. You do love me. Say it. Say it." His hands still rested on her shoulders, and she felt them tremble and loved their trembling. She leaned toward him ardently, but he held her away from him, looking at her with eyes from which all remoteness had fled, eyes tormented with struggle and despair. "Don't," he said. "Don't. If you do, I shall take you now, here." She smiled a bright, hot smile which was forgetful of time or place or anything but the memory of his mouth on hers. Suddenly he shook her until her black hair tumbled down about her shoulders, shook her as if in a mad rage at her and at himself. "We won't do this," he said. "I tell you, we won't do it." It seemed as if her neck would snap if he shook her again. She was blinded by her hair and stunned by his action. She wrenched herself away and stared at him. There were small beads of moisture on his forehead, and his fists were curled into claws as if in pain. He looked at her directly, his gray eyes piercing. "It's all my fault. None of yours, and it will never happen again, because I am going to take Melanie and the baby and go." "Go?" she cried in anguish. "Oh, no!" "Yes, by God. Do you think I'll stay here after this, when this might happen again?" "But, Ashley, you can't go. Why should you go? You love me." "You want me to say it? All right, I'll say it. I love you." He leaned over her with a sudden savagery which made her shrink back against the fence. "I love you, your courage and your stubbornness and your fire and your utter ruthlessness. How much do I love you? So much that a moment ago I would have outraged the hospitality of the house which has sheltered me and my family, forgotten the best wife any man ever had, enough to take you here in the mud like a—" She struggled with a chaos of thoughts, and there was a cold pain in her heart, as if an icicle had pierced it. She said haltingly, "If you felt like that, and didn't take me, then you don't love me." "I can never make you understand." They fell silent and looked at each other. Suddenly Scarlett shivered and saw, as if coming back from a long journey, that it was winter, and the fields were bare and harsh with stubble, and she was very cold. She saw, too, that the old, aloof face of Ashley, the one she knew so well, had come back, and it was wintry, too, and harsh with hurt and remorse. She would have turned and left him then, seeking the shelter of the house to hide herself, but she was too tired to move. Even speech was a labor and a weariness. "There's nothing left," she said at last. "Nothing left for me. Nothing to love.
nothing to fight for. You are gone, and Terra is going. He looked at her for a long space, and then, leaning, scooped up a small wad of red clay from the ground. Yes, there is something left, he said. And the ghost of his old smile came back, the smile which mocked himself as well as her. Something you love better than me, though you may not know it. You've still got Terra. He took her limp hand and pressed the damp clay into it and closed her fingers about it. There was no fever in his hands now, nor in hers. She looked at the red soil for a moment, and it meant nothing to her. She looked at him and realized dimly that there was an integrity of spirit in him which was not to be torn apart by her passionate hands, nor by any hands. If it killed him, he would never leave Melanie. If he burned for Scarlet until the end of his days, he would never take her, and he would fight to keep her at a distance. She would never again get through that armor. The words, hospitality, and loyalty and honor meant more to him than she did. The clay was cold in her hand, and she looked at it again. Yes, she said. I've still got this. At first, the words meant nothing, and the clay was only red clay. But unbidden came the thought of the sea of red dirt which surrounded Terra, and how very dear it was, and how hard she had fought to keep it. How hard she was going to have to fight if she wished to keep it hereafter. She looked at him again and wondered where the hot flood of feeling had gone. She could think, but could not feel. Not about him nor Terra either, for she was drained of all emotion. You need not go, she said clearly. I won't have you all starve, simply because I've thrown myself at your head. It will never happen again. She turned away and started back toward the house across the rough fields, twisting her hair into a knot upon her neck. Ashley watched her go and saw her square her small, thin shoulders as she went. And that gesture went to his heart. More than any words she had spoken. Chapter 32. She was still clutching the ball of red clay when she went up the front steps. She had carefully avoided the back entrance, for Mammy's sharp eyes would certainly have seen that something was greatly amiss. Scarlet didn't want to see Mammy or anyone else. She didn't feel that she could endure seeing anyone or talking to anyone again. She had no feeling of shame or disappointment or bitterness now, only a weakness of the knees and a great emptiness of heart. She squeezed the clay so tightly it ran out from her clenched fist, and she said over and over, parrot-like, "I've still got this. Yes, I've still got this." There was nothing else she did have. Nothing but this red land. This land she had been willing to throw away like a torn handkerchief only a few minutes before. Now it was dear to her again, and she wondered dully what madness had possessed her to hold it so lightly. Had Ashley yielded, she could have gone away with him and left family and friends without a backward look. But even in her emptiness, she knew it would have torn her heart to leave these dear red hills and long-washed gullies and gaunt black pines. Her thoughts would have turned back to them hungrily until the day she died. Not even Ashley could have filled the empty spaces in her heart where Terra had been uprooted.
how wise Ashley was, and how well he knew her. He had only to press the damp earth into her hand to bring her to her senses. She was in the hall preparing to close the door when she heard the sound of horses' hooves and turned to look down the driveway. To have visitors at this, of all times, was too much. She'd hurry to her room and plead a headache. But when the carriage came nearer, her flight was checked by her amazement. It was a new carriage, shiny with varnish, and the harness was new, too, with bits of polished brass here and there. Strangers, certainly. No one she knew had the money for such a grand new turnout as this. She stood in the doorway watching, the cold draft blowing her skirts about her damp ankles. Then the carriage stopped in front of the house, and Jonas Wilkerson alighted. Scarlett was so surprised at the sight of their former overseer driving so fine a rig, and in so splendid a greatcoat, she could not for a moment believe her eyes. Will had told her he looked quite prosperous since he got his new job with the Freedmen's Bureau. Made a lot of money, Will said, swindling the niggers or the government, one or t'other, or confiscating folks' cotton and swearing it was Confederate government cotton. Certainly he never came by all that money honestly in these hard times. And here he was now, stepping out of an elegant carriage and handing down a woman dressed within an inch of her life. Scarlett saw in a glance that the dress was bright in color, to the point of vulgarity. But nevertheless, her eyes went over the outfit hungrily. It had been so long since she had even seen stylish new clothes. Well, so hoops aren't so wide this year, she thought, scanning the red plaid gown. And as she took in the black velvet paletot, how short jackets are! And what a cunning hat! Bonnets must be out of style, for this hat was only an absurd flat red velvet affair, perched on top of the woman's head like a stiffened pancake. The ribbons didn't tie under the chin as bonnet ribbons tied, but in the back, under the massive bunch of curls, which fell from the rear of the hat, curls which Scarlett could not help noticing didn't match the woman's hair in either color or texture. As the woman stepped to the ground and looked toward the house, Scarlett saw there was something familiar about the rabbity face, caked with white powder. "Why, it's Emmy Slattery!" she cried, so surprised she spoke the words aloud. "Yes'm, it's me," said Emmy, tossing her head with an ingratiating smile and starting toward the steps. Emmy Slattery! The dirty, tow-headed slut whose illegitimate baby Ellen had baptized. Emmy, who had given typhoid to Ellen and killed her. This overdressed, common, nasty piece of poor white trash was coming up the steps of Tara, bridling and grinning as if she belonged here. Scarlett thought of Ellen, and in a rush, feeling came back into the emptiness of her mind. A murderous rage so strong it shook her like the ague. "Get off those steps, you trashy wench!" she cried. "Get off this land! Get out!" Emmy's jaw sagged suddenly, and she glanced at Jonas, who came up with lowering brows. He made an effort at dignity despite his anger. "You must not speak that way to my wife," he said. "Wife," said Scarlett, and burst into a laugh that was cutting with contempt. "High time you made her your wife. Who baptized your other brats after you killed my mother?" Emmy said, "Oh," and retreated hastily down the steps. But Jonas stopped her flight toward the carriage with a rough grip on her arm. "We came out here to pay a call, a friendly call," he snarled. "And talk a little business with old friends." "Friends?" Scarlett's voice was like a whiplash. "When were we ever friends with the like of you? The Slattery's lived on our charity and paid it back. By killing Mother. And you, Pa discharged you about Emmy's brat, and you know it. Friends, get off this place before I call Mr. Benteen and Mr. Wilkes. Under the words, Emmy broke her husband's hold and fled for the carriage, scrambling in with a flash of patent leather boots with bright red tops and red tassels. Now Jonas shook with a fury equal to Scarlet's, and his sallow face was as red as an angry turkey gobbler's. Still high and mighty, aren't you? Well, I know all about you. I know you haven't got shoes for your feet. I know your father's turned idiot. Get off this place! Oh, you won't sing that way very long. I know you're broke. I know you can't even pay your taxes. I came out here to offer to buy this place from you, to make you a right good offer. Emmy had a hankering to live here. But by God, I won't give you a cent now. You high-flying, bog-trotting Irish will find out who's running things around here when you get sold out for taxes, and I'll buy this place lock, stock, and barrel, furniture and all, and I'll live in it. So, it was Jonas Wilkerson who wanted Tara. Jonas and Emmy, who in some twisted way thought to even past slights by living in the home where they had been slighted. All her nerves hummed with hate, as they had hummed that day when she shoved the pistol barrel into the Yankee's bearded face and fired. She wished she had that pistol now.
I'll tear this house down stone by stone and burn it and sow every acre with salt before I see either of you put foot over this threshold, she shouted. Get out, I tell you! Get out!
Jonas glared at her, started to say more, and then walked toward the carriage. He climbed in beside his whimpering wife and turned the horse. As they drove off, Scarlet had the impulse to spit at them. She did spit. She knew it was a common, childish gesture, but it made her feel better. She wished she had done it while they could see her. Those damned nigger lovers daring to come here and taunt her about her poverty. That hound never intended offering her a price for Tara. He just used that as an excuse to come and flaunt himself and Emmy in her face. The dirty scallywags, the lousy, trashy poor whites boasting they would live at Tara. Then sudden terror struck her, and her rage melted. God's nightgown! They will come and live here. There was nothing she could do to keep them from buying Tara, nothing to keep them from levying on every mirror and table and bed, on Ellen's shining mahogany and rosewood, and every bit of it precious to her, scarred though it was by the Yankee raiders, and the Robillard silver, too. I won't let them do it, thought Scarlet vehemently. No, not if I've got to burn the place down. Emmy Slattery will never set her foot on a single bit of flooring Mother ever walked on. She closed the door and leaned against it, and she was very frightened. More frightened even than she had been that day when Sherman's army was in the house. That day the worst she could fear was that Tara would be burned over her head. But this was worse. These low common creatures living in this house, bragging to their low common friends how they had turned the proud O'Haras out. Perhaps they'd even bring Negroes here to dine and sleep. Will had told her Jonas made a great to-do about being equal with the Negroes, ate with them, visited in their houses, rode them around with him in his carriage, put his arms around their shoulders. When she thought of the possibility of this final insult to Tara, her heart pounded so hard she could scarcely breathe. She was trying to get her mind on her problem, trying to figure some way out, but each time she collected her thoughts, fresh gusts of rage and fear shook her. There must be some way out. There must be someone somewhere who had money she could borrow. Money couldn't just dry up and blow away. Somebody had to have money. Then the laughing words of Ashley came back to her. Only one person, Rhett Butler, who has money. Rhett Butler. She walked quickly into the parlor and shut the door behind her. The dim gloom of drawn blinds and winter twilight closed about her. No one would think of hunting for her here, and she wanted time to think, undisturbed. The idea which had just occurred to her was so simple, she wondered why she hadn't thought of it before. "I'll get the money from Rhett. I'll sell him the diamond earbobs, or I'll borrow the money from him and let him keep the earbobs till I can pay him back." For a moment, relief was so great she felt weak. She would pay the taxes and laugh in Jonas Wilkerson's face. But close on this happy thought came relentless knowledge. "It's not only for this year that I'll need tax money. There's next year, and all the years of my life. If I pay up this time, they'll raise the taxes higher next time till they drive me out. If I make a good cotton crop, they'll tax it till I'll get nothing for it, or maybe confiscate it outright and say it's Confederate cotton. The Yankees and the scoundrels teamed up with them have got me where they want me. All my life, as long as I live, I'll be afraid they'll get me somehow. All my life, I'll be scared and scrambling for money and working myself to death, only to see my work go for nothing and my cotton stolen. Just borrowing $300 for the taxes will be only a stopgap. What I want is to get out of this fix for good, so I can go to sleep at night without worrying over what's going to happen to me tomorrow, and next month, and next year." Her mind ticked on steadily. Coldly and logically, an idea grew in her brain. She thought of Rhett, a flash of white teeth against swarthy skin, sardonic black eyes caressing her. She recalled the hot night in Atlanta, close to the end of the siege, when he sat on Aunt Pitty's porch half hidden in the summer darkness. And she felt again the heat of his hand upon her arm as he said, "I want you more than I have ever wanted any woman. And I've waited longer for you than I've ever waited for any woman." "I'll marry him," she thought coolly. "And then I'll never have to bother about money again." Oh, blessed thought! Sweeter than hope of heaven, never to worry about money again, to know that Tara was safe, that the family was fed and clothed, that she would never again have to bruise herself against stone walls. She felt very old. The afternoon's events had drained her of all feeling. First, the startling news about the taxes, then Ashley, and last, her murderous rage at Jonas Wilkerson. No, there was no emotion left in her. If all her capacity to feel had not been utterly exhausted, something in her would have protested against the plan taking form in her mind. For she hated Rhett, as she hated no other person in all the world. But she could not feel. She could only think, and her thoughts were very practical. "I said some terrible things to him that night when he deserted us on the road. But I can make him forget them," she thought contemptuously, still sure of her power to charm. "Butter won't melt in my mouth when I'm around him. I'll make him think I always loved him and was just upset and frightened that night. Oh, men are so conceited they'll believe anything that flatters them. I must never let him dream what straits we're in, not till I've got him. Oh, he mustn't know. If he even suspected how poor we are, he'd know it was his money I wanted and not himself. After all, there's no way he could know, for even Aunt Pitty doesn't know the worst. And after I've married him, he'll have to help us. He can't let his wife's people starve." His wife, Mrs. Rhett Butler, something of repulsion, buried deep beneath her cold thinking, stirred faintly, and then was stilled. She remembered the embarrassing and disgusting events of her brief honeymoon with Charles, his fumbling hands, his awkwardness, his incomprehensible emotions. And Wade Hampton.
I won't think about it now. I'll bother about it after I've married him.
After she had married him, memory rang a bell. A chill went down her spine. She remembered again that night on Aunt Pitty's porch. Remembered how she asked him if he was proposing to her. Remembered how hatefully he had laughed and said, "My dear, I'm not a marrying man." Suppose he was still not a marrying man. Suppose, despite all her charms and wiles, he refused to marry her. Suppose, oh, terrible thought! Suppose he had completely forgotten about her and was chasing after some other woman.
"I want you more than I have ever wanted any woman."
Scarlett's nails dug into her palms as she clenched her fists.
"If he's forgotten me, I'll make him remember me. I'll make him want me again."
And if he wouldn't marry her, but still wanted her, there was a way to get the money. After all, he had once asked her to be his mistress. In the dim grayness of the parlor, she fought a quick, decisive battle with the three most binding ties of her soul. The memory of Ellen, the teachings of her religion, and her love for Ashley. She knew that what she had in her mind must be hideous to her mother, even in that warm, far-off heaven where she surely was. She knew that fornication was a mortal sin. And she knew that, loving Ashley as she did, her plan was doubly prostitution. But all these things went down before the merciless coldness of her mind and the goad of desperation. Ellen was dead, and perhaps death gave an understanding of all things. Religion forbade fornication on pain of hellfire, but if the church thought she was going to leave one stone unturned in saving Tara and saving the family from starving, well, let the church bother about that. She wouldn't. At least not now. And Ashley... Ashley didn't want her. Yes, he did want her. The memory of his warm mouth on hers told her that. But he would never take her away with him. Strange that going away with Ashley didn't seem like a sin. But with Rhett... In the dull twilight of the winter afternoon, she came to the end of the long road which had begun the night Atlanta fell. She had set her feet upon the road a spoiled, selfish, and untried girl, full of youth, warm of emotion, easily bewildered by life. Now, at the end of the road, there was nothing left of that girl. Hunger and hard labor, fear and constant strain, and the terrors of war and the terrors of Reconstruction had taken away all warmth and youth and softness. About the core of her being, a shell of hardness had formed, and little by little, layer by layer, the shell had thickened during the endless months. But until this very day, two hopes had been left to sustain her. She had hoped that the war being over, life would gradually resume its old face. She had hoped that Ashley's return would bring back some meaning into life. Now both hopes were gone. The sight of Jonas Wilkerson in the front walk of Tara had made her realize that for her, for the whole South, the war would never end. The bitterest fighting, the most brutal retaliations were just beginning. And Ashley was imprisoned forever by words which were stronger than any jail. peace had failed her. And Ashley had failed her, both in the same day. And it was as if the last crevice in the shell had been sealed, the final layer hardened. She had become what Grandma Fontaine had counseled against, a woman who had seen the worst, and so had nothing else to fear. Not life, nor mother, nor loss of love, nor public opinion. Only hunger, and her nightmare dream of hunger, could make her afraid. A curious sense of lightness, of freedom, pervaded her now that she had finally hardened her heart against all that bound her to the old days and the old Scarlet. She had made her decision, and thank God she wasn't afraid. She had nothing to lose, and her mind was made up. If she could only coax Rhett into marrying her, all would be perfect. But if she couldn't, well, she'd get the money just the same. For a brief moment she wondered with impersonal curiosity what would be expected of a mistress. Would Rhett insist on keeping her in Atlanta as people said he kept the Watling woman? If he made her stay in Atlanta, he'd have to pay well. Pay enough to balance what her absence from Terra would be worth. Scarlet was very ignorant of the hidden side of men's lives, and had no way of knowing just what the arrangement might involve. And she wondered if she would have a baby. That would be distinctly terrible. "I won't think of that now. I'll think of it later." And she pushed the unwelcome idea into the back of her mind, lest it shake her resolution. She'd tell the family tonight she was going to Atlanta to try to borrow money, to try to mortgage the farm if necessary. That would be all they needed to know until such an evil day when they might find out differently. With the thought of action, her head went up and her shoulders went back. This affair was not going to be easy, she knew. Formerly, it had been Rhett who asked for her favors, and she who held the power. Now she was the beggar, and a beggar in no position to dictate terms. "But I won't go to him like a beggar. I'll go like a queen granting favors. He'll never know." She walked to the long pier glass and looked at herself, her head held high. And she saw framed in the cracking gilt molding a stranger. It was as if she were really seeing herself for the first time in a year. She had glanced in the mirror every morning to see that her face was clean and her hair tidy, but she had always been too pressed by other things to really see herself. But this stranger... Surely this thin, hollow-cheeked woman couldn't be Scarlet O'Hara. Scarlet O'Hara had a pretty coquettish, high-spirited face. This face at which she stared was not pretty at all, and had none of the charm she remembered so well. It was white and strained, and the black brows above slanting green eyes swooped up startlingly against the white skin like frightened birds' wings. There was a hard and hunted look about this face. "I'm not pretty enough to get him," she thought. And desperation came back to her. "I'm thin. Oh, I'm terribly thin." She patted her cheeks, felt frantically at her collarbones, feeling them stand out through her basque. And her breasts were so small, almost as small as Melanie's. She'd have to put ruffles in her bosom to make them look larger. And she had always had contempt for girls who resorted to such subterfuges. Ruffles? That brought up another thought. Her clothes. She looked down at her dress, spreading its mended folds wide between her hands. Rhett liked women who were well-dressed, fashionably dressed. She remembered with longing the flounced green dress she had worn when she first came out of mourning, the dress she wore with a green plumed bonnet he had brought her, and she recalled the approving compliments he had paid her.
She remembered, too, with hate sharpened by envy, the red plaid dress, the red-topped boots with tassels, and the pancake hat of Emmy Slattery. They were gaudy, but they were new and fashionable, and certainly they caught the eye. And, oh, how she wanted to catch the eye! Especially the eye of Rhett Butler! If he should see her in her old clothes, he'd know everything was wrong at Terra, and he must not know. What a fool she had been to think she could go to Atlanta and have him for the asking. She with her scrawny neck and hungry cat eyes and raggedy dress. If she hadn't been able to pry a proposal from him at the height of her beauty, when she had her prettiest clothes, how could she expect to get one now when she was ugly and dressed tackily? If Miss Pitty's story was true, he must have more money than anyone in Atlanta, and probably had his pick of all the pretty ladies, good and bad. Well, she thought grimly, I've got something that most pretty ladies haven't got. And that's a mind that's made up. And if I had just one nice dress... There wasn't a nice dress in Tara, or a dress which hadn't been turned twice and mended. That's that, she thought, disconsolately looking down at the floor. She saw Ellen's moss-green velvet carpet, now worn and scuffed and torn and spotted from the numberless men who had slept upon it, and the sight depressed her more, for it made her realize that Tara was just as ragged as she. The whole darkening room depressed her, and going to the window, she raised the sash, unlatched the shutters, and let the last light of the wintry sunset into the room. She closed the window and leaned her head against the velvet curtains and looked out across the bleak pasture toward the dark cedars of the burying ground. The moss-green velvet curtains felt prickly and soft beneath her cheek, and she rubbed her face against them gratefully, like a cat. And then suddenly, she looked at them. A minute later, she was dragging a heavy marble-topped table across the floor, its rusty caster screeching in protest. She rolled the table under the window, gathered up her skirts, climbed on it, and tiptoed to reach the heavy curtain pole. It was almost out of her reach, and she jerked at it so impatiently the nails came out of the wood, and the curtains, pole and all, fell to the floor with a clatter. As if by magic, the door of the parlor opened, and the wide black face of Mammy appeared, ardent curiosity and deepest suspicion evident in every wrinkle. She looked disapprovingly at Scarlet, poised on the tabletop, her skirts above her knees, ready to leap to the floor. There was a look of excitement and triumph on her face, which brought sudden distrust to Mammy.
"What are you up to with Miss Ellen's poteers?" she demanded.
"What are you up to listening outside doors?" asked Scarlet, leaping nimbly to the floor and gathering up a length of the heavy, dusty velvet.
"That ain't neither here nor there,"
countered Mammy, girding herself for combat.
"You ain't got no business with Miss Ellen's poteers, jugging the poles plumb out of the wood and dropping them on the floor in the dust. Miss Ellen set great store by them poteers, and I ain't tending to have you mess 'em up that way."
Scarlet turned green eyes on Mammy, eyes which were feverishly gay. Eyes which looked like the bad little girl of the good old days Mammy sighed about. "Scoot up to the attic and get my box of dress patterns, Mammy," she cried, giving her a slight shove. "I'm going to have a new dress." Mammy was torn between indignation at the very idea of her 200 pounds scooting anywhere, much less to the attic, and the dawning of a horrid suspicion. Quickly she snatched the curtain lengths from Scarlet, holding them against her monumental sagging breasts as if they were holy relics.
"Not out of Miss Ellen's poteers is you gwine to have a new dress," if that's what you're figuring on. Not while I've got breath in my body.
For a moment, the expression Mammy was wont to describe to herself as bullheaded flitted over her young mistress's face, and then it passed into a smile, so difficult for Mammy to resist. But it didn't fool the old woman. She knew Miss Scarlet was employing that smile merely to get around her, and in this matter she was determined not to be gotten around.
"Mammy, don't be mean. I'm going to Atlanta to borrow some money, and I've got to have a new dress."
"You don't need no new dress. Ain't no other ladies got new dresses. They wears their old ones, and they wears them proudly. Ain't no reason why Miss Ellen's child can't wear rags if she wants to, and everybody respect her like she wore silk."
The bull-headed expression began to creep back.
Lordy, it was right funny how the older Miss Scarlet get, the more she looked like Mr. Gerald, and the less like Miss Ellen.
"Now, Mammy, you know Aunt Pitty wrote us that Miss Fanny Elsing is getting married this Saturday, and of course I'll go to the wedding. And I need a new dress to wear."
"The dress you've got on will be just as nice as Miss Fanny's wedding dress. Miss Pitty done wrote that the Elsing's mighty poor."
"But I've got to have a new dress. Mammy, you don't know how we need money. The taxes."
"Yes'm. I know all about the taxes, but..."
"You do?"
"Well'm, God give me ears, didn't he? And to hear with. Especially when Mr. Will don't never take trouble to close the door."
Was there nothing Mammy did not overhear? Scarlet wondered how that ponderous body which shook the floors could move with such savage stealth when its owner wished to eavesdrop. "Well, if you heard all that, I suppose you heard Jonas Wilkerson and that Emmy..."
"Yes'm," said Mammy with smoldering eyes.
"Well, don't be a mule, Mammy. Don't you see I've got to go to Atlanta and get money for the taxes? I've got to get some money. I've got to do it."
She hammered one small fist into the other.
"Name of God, Mammy, they'll turn us all out into the road, and then where'll we go? Are you going to argue with me about a little matter of Mother's curtains when that trash Emmy Slattery, who killed Mother, is fixing to move into this house and sleep in the bed Mother slept in?"
Mammy shifted from one foot to another like a restive elephant. She had a dim feeling that she was being got around.
"No'm, I ain't one to see trash in Miss Ellen's house, or us all in the road, but..."
She fixed Scarlet with a suddenly accusing eye.
"Who is you fixin' to get money from that you needs a new dress?"
"That," said Scarlet, taken aback, "is my own business."
Mary looked at her piercingly. Just as she had done when Scarlet was small and had tried unsuccessfully to palm off plausible excuses for misdeeds. She seemed to be reading her mind, and Scarlet dropped her eyes unwillingly, the first feeling of guilt at her intended conduct creeping over her.
"So you needs a spang new pretty dress to borrow money with. That don't listen just right to me. And you ain't saying where the money to come from."
"I'm not saying anything," said Scarlet indignantly. "It's my own business. Are you going to give me that curtain and help me make the dress?"
"Yes'm,"
said Mammy softly, capitulating with a suddenness which aroused all the suspicion in Scarlet's mind.
"I gwine to help you make it, and I specs we might get a petticoat out of the satin lining of these portieres and trim a pair of pantalettes with the lace curtains."
She handed the velvet curtain back to Scarlet, and a sly smile spread over her face.
"Miss Melly gwine to Atlanta with you, Miss Scarlet?"
"No," said Scarlet sharply, beginning to realize what was coming. "I'm going by myself."
"That's what you thinks,"
said Mammy firmly. But I is going with you and dat new dress. Yes'm, every step of the way.
For an instant, Scarlet envisaged her trip to Atlanta, and her conversation with Rhett, with Mammy glowering chaperonage like a large black Cerberus in the background. She smiled again and put a hand on Mammy's arm.
Mammy, darling, you're sweet to want to go with me and help me, but how on earth would the folks here get on without you? You know you just about run, Tara.
Huh, said Mammy. Don't do no good to sweet talk me, Miss Scarlet. I've been knowing you since I put the first pair of diapers on you. I said I was going to Atlanta with you, and gwine I is. Miss Ellen be turning in her grave, and you gwine off dar by yourself with that town full up with Yankees and free niggers and such like.
But I'll be at Aunt Pittipat's, Scarlet offered frantically.
Miss Pittipat a fine woman, and she thinks she see everything, but she don't, said Mammy.
And turning with a majestic air of having closed the interview, she went into the hall. The boards trembled as she called.
Prissy child, fly up the stairs and fetch Miss Scarlet's pattern box from the attic, and try and find the scissors without taking all night about it.
This is a fine mess, thought Scarlet dejectedly. I'd as soon have a bloodhound after me.
After supper had been cleared away, Scarlet and Mammy spread patterns on the dining room table while Sue Ellen and Corrine busily ripped satin linings from curtains, and Melanie brushed the velvet with a clean hairbrush to remove the dust. Gerald, Will, and Ashley sat about the room smoking, smiling at the feminine tumult. A feeling of pleasurable excitement, which seemed to emanate from Scarlet, was on them all, an excitement they couldn't understand. There was color in Scarlet's face, and a bright, hard glitter in her eyes, and she laughed a good deal. Her laughter pleased them all, for it had been months since they had heard her really laugh. Especially did it please Gerald. His eyes were less vague than usual as they followed her swishing figure about the room, and he patted her approvingly whenever she was within reach. The girls were as excited as if preparing for a ball, and they ripped and cut and basted as if making a ball dress of their own. Scarlet was going to Atlanta to borrow money, or to mortgage Tara if necessary. But what was a mortgage after all? Scarlet said they could easily pay it off out of next year's cotton and have money left over. And she said it was such finality they didn't think to question. And when they asked who was going to lend the money, she said, "Layovers catch meddlers." So archly, they all laughed and teased her about her millionaire friend. "It must be Captain Rhett Butler," said Melanie slyly. And they exploded with mirth at this absurdity, knowing how Scarlet hated him and never failed to refer to him as "that skunk, Rhett Butler." But Scarlet didn't laugh at this. And Ashley, who had laughed, stopped abruptly as he saw Mammy shoot a quick, guarded glance at Scarlet. Sue Ellen, moved to generosity by the party spirit of the occasion, produced her Irish lace collar, somewhat worn, but still pretty. And Corrine insisted that Scarlet wear her slippers to Atlanta, for they were in better condition than any others at Terra. Melanie begged Mammy to leave her enough velvet scraps to recover the frame of her battered bonnet, and brought shouts of laughter when she said the old rooster was going to part with his gorgeous bronze and green-black tail feathers unless he took to the swamp immediately. Scarlet, watching the flying fingers, heard the laughter and looked at them all with concealed bitterness and contempt. "They haven't an idea what is really happening to me, or to themselves, or to the South. They still think, in spite of everything, that nothing really dreadful can happen to any of them because they are who they are, O'Haras, Wilkeses, Hamiltons.
Even the darkies feel that way. Oh, they're all fools. They'll never realize. They'll go right on thinking and living as they always have, and nothing will change them. Melly can dress in rags and pick cotton, and even help me murder a man, but it doesn't change her. She's still the shy, well-bred Mrs. Wilkes, the perfect lady. And Ashley can see death and war and be wounded and lie in jail and come home to less than nothing and still be the same gentleman he was when he had all 12 Oaks behind him. Will is different. He knows how things really are, but then Will never had anything much to lose. And as for Sue Ellen and Corrine, they think all this is just a temporary matter. They don't change to meet changed conditions because they think it'll all be over soon. They think God is going to work a miracle, especially for their benefit. But he won't. The only miracle that's going to be worked around here is the one I'm going to work on Rhett Butler. They won't change. Maybe they can't change. I'm the only one who's changed. And I wouldn't have changed if I could have helped it. Mammy finally turned the men out of the dining room and closed the door so the fitting could begin. Pork helped Gerald upstairs to bed, and Ashley and Will were left alone in the lamplight in the front hall. They were silent for a while, and Will chewed his tobacco like a placid, ruminant animal. But his mild face was far from placid. "This going to Atlanta," he said at last in a slow voice. "I don't like it. Not one bit." Ashley looked at Will quickly, and then looked away, saying nothing, but wondering if Will had the same awful suspicion which was haunting him. But that was impossible. Will didn't know what had taken place in the orchard that afternoon, and how it had driven Scarlet to desperation. Will couldn't have noticed Mammy's face when Rhett Butler's name was mentioned, and besides, Will didn't know about Rhett's money or his foul reputation. At least, Ashley didn't think he could know these things. But since coming back to Tara, he had realized that Will, like Mammy, seemed to know things without being told, to sense them before they happened. There was something ominous in the air. Exactly what, Ashley didn't know. But he was powerless to save Scarlet from it. She hadn't met his eyes once that evening, and the hard, bright gaiety with which she had treated him was frightening. The suspicions which tore at him were too terrible to be put into words. He didn't have the right to insult her by asking her if they were true. He clenched his fists. He had no rights at all where she was concerned. This afternoon, he had forfeited them all forever. He could not help her. No one could help her. But when he thought of Mammy, and the look of grim determination she wore as she cut into the velvet curtains, he was cheered a little. Mammy would take care of Scarlet, whether Scarlet wished it or not. "I have caused all this," he thought despairingly. "I have driven her to this." He remembered the way she had squared her shoulders when she turned away from him that afternoon, remembered the stubborn lift of her head. His heart went out to her, torn with his own helplessness, wrenched with admiration. He knew she had no such word in her vocabulary as gallantry. Knew she would have stared blankly if he had told her she was the most gallant soul he had ever known. He knew she wouldn't understand how many truly fine things he ascribed to her when he thought of her as gallant. He knew that she took life as it came, opposed her tough-fibered mind to whatever obstacles there might be, fought on with a determination that would not recognize defeat, and kept on fighting, even when she saw defeat was inevitable. But for 4 years,
he had seen others who had refused to recognize defeat. Men who rode gaily into sure disaster because they were gallant. And they had been defeated just the same. He thought, as he stared at Will in the shadowy hall, that he had never known such gallantry as the gallantry of Scarlett O'Hara going forth to conquer the world in her mother's velvet curtains and the tail feathers of a rooster. Chapter 33. A cold wind was blowing stiffly, and the scudding clouds overhead were the deep gray of slate when Scarlett and Mammy stepped from the train in Atlanta the next afternoon. The depot hadn't been rebuilt since the burning of the city, and they alighted amid cinders and mud a few yards above the blackened ruins which marked the site. Habit strong upon her, Scarlett looked about for Uncle Peter in Pitty's carriage, for she had always been met by them when returning from Tara to Atlanta during the war years. Then she caught herself with a sniff at her own absent-mindedness. Naturally, Peter wasn't there, for she had given Aunt Pitty no warning of her coming, and moreover, she remembered that one of the old lady's letters had dealt tearfully with the death of the old nag Peter had acquired in Macon to bring her back to Atlanta after the surrender. She looked about the rutted and cut-up space around the depot for the equipage of some old friend or acquaintance who might drive them to Aunt Pitty's house, but she recognized no one, black or white. Probably none of her old friends owned carriages now, if what Pitty had written them was true. Times were so hard it was difficult to feed and lodge humans, much less animals. Most of Pitty's friends, like herself,